When we ended last time, we were talking about NAD, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Remember, that's what that stands for. Now, if we look at a picture of this, we can make sense of the name. But let me write down that it's nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So, first of all, it is a dinucleotide. Well, what does that tell you? It means that there are two nucleotides hooked together, just like a dipeptide is two amino acids hooked together. All right? Now think back to what it means to be a nucleotide. A nucleotide, like in a polynucleotide, DNA or RNA, for instance, has three parts to it, remember. A nucleotide has a pentose sugar, to which is connected a nitrogenous base on one side of the sugar, and on the other side of the sugar, some number of phosphates. Well, look at the picture of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. This bottom part, the green sugar here, is ribose, so it's the same sugar as in RNA. This is adenine, this nitrogenous base in gold. And if you just consider this phosphate and these, all three of these things on the bottom, if those existed stuck together on their own, that would be an adenine nucleotide. The rest of it is another nucleotide, except it doesn't use one of the conventional nitrogenous bases that you find in RNA or DNA. This is nicotinamide, a different kind of nitrogenous base. It's not used in RNA or DNA, but it still can be part of a nucleotide. And therefore, these three by themselves, stuck together, would be a nicotinamide nucleotide. And when you have both nucleotides hooked together at their phosphates, you have a nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. That explains the name of it. Functionally, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD, is a coenzyme, as I mentioned before. Coenzymes act as carrier molecules. That's why I likened them to taxis. Think about them as little taxis because they pick things up and drop them off. NAD is an energy-carrying taxi because the passengers that NAD carries are electrons and protons that come from the hydrogen atoms that get picked off of the fuel during dehydrogenation. Dehydrogenation is the way that fuels get oxidized. And always keep track of the fact that we use our fuels by oxidizing them. That's how we extract the energy. The energy comes in the form of the electrons and protons that come off of the fuel in the form of hydrogen atoms, and those electrons and protons get carried by coenzymes to a later part of the process that we'll get to eventually. Now, this is the entire structure of an NAD, but remember these taxis or coenzymes exist in two forms, just like real taxis do. Any given taxi on the street can be in service, meaning, or it can be a full taxi, it's carrying passengers, or it can be available, not carrying passengers. Well, since the passengers include electrons for NAD, then the two forms of the taxi, empty and full, correspond to oxidized and reduced, right? Because those words are about whether or not the electrons are there. Which is the full taxi? No, I mean of the two possibilities, oxidized and reduced, which is the full taxi? Reduced, because reduced means carrying the electrons. Okay, well, the right side of the figure doesn't show the entire structure again, even though it's there. So just imagine it's the same. The only reason they show just part of it on the right side is that even though this is the overall structure, it's this nicotinamide nitrogenous base that is the part of the overall NAD molecule that can become oxidized and reduced. In other words, that can pick up electrons and drop them off. So the left side is the NAD plus form, which is the oxidized form. That's the empty taxi, much lower energy because it's not carrying those energetic passengers. When the electrons come, and the electrons and protons, this is what I explained before, one of those two electrons turns it into NAD without the plus. One more electron and a proton turn it into NADH, and then you still have a leftover proton because you started out taking two hydrogens off, right? You have two electrons, two protons. Three of those fit onto NAD plus to make it NADH, and then you also have a leftover proton. So that's why we symbolize the reduced, higher energy, full taxi version of NAD as NADH and H+. The H+ is not actually being carried by the taxi. It's just in solution. But it came from the fuel. It was part of one of those hydrogen atoms that get dehydrogenated from the fuel. So all the rest of this stuff is still here on the right side. It's just that this nicotinamide is the business end of the molecule in terms of carrying or dropping off electrons and protons. And this right side, the reduced form, is much higher energy. That's why I say this coenzyme is not just a taxi, it's an energy taxi. Because those electrons and protons that are carrying will pay off in the end of the process, once we get there, in the form of a lot of ATP, a lot of additional ATP molecules being made. All right, let's go to 8. On the left side of 8, we have, this is a graph, notice, with a y-axis and G, which is free energy. So the higher up on the graph, the higher the value of free energy. What we have here, though, is a combustion reaction. In this case, it's not an organic fuel, though. There's no carbon involved. This is just pure hydrogen, which is a good fuel. It will combust with oxygen very well, which is why the Hindenburg blew up. But if you do that, if you put flame to hydrogen gas, it will be a single reaction. And there is a tremendous release of energy. That's why the Y value is going way down to get to the product, which is just water. Okay? So you burn hydrogen, you get water as the... There's no carbon dioxide produced like in organic fuel combustion because there's no carbon originally. Right? It's just hydrogen turning into water. That delta G represents the distance between these Gs. Highly exergonic, which you'd expect for a fuel, right? Combustions of fuels are exergonic reactions. Well, the hydrogen here can be used on its own as gas. You can put flame to it. Or you can think of hydrogen as the useful stuff that we pick off of the fuels in cells. So that's the hydrogen that's on the right side. That's hydrogen from the fuel molecule, from glucose. Except that we don't put flame to it and release all of the energy at once. We do it very gradually, many steps, and each step releases a little bit of energy. So it's manageable for the cell. It doesn't kill it with an explosive release of heat. And it also, doing it stepwise, allows some of the energy a little bit at a time to be captured in order to produce ATP molecules to store that energy. That's what this overall process that this chapter is about is concerned with. And that overall process, remember, is the complete oxidation of glucose. All right? If you think back to previous chapters, slides that compared organisms as open systems to multi-step open hydroelectric plants, remember those slides? That was like this thing labeled here as the electron transport chain, which is an important part that I'll explain eventually of the overall process. That's where energy is released just a little bit at a time, so it's manageable. But Another important part of this is that even though it's not directly going from hydrogen to water in one step, the only thing that matters to delta G is beginning and ending, not how you get there. So the overall release of energy is the same exact amount in the right side in a cell as it would be if you did it all in one step by lighting the hydrogen gas. Okay, now to 9, and this is where we can finally start talking about the main topic of the chapter, which is, once again, is the complete oxidation of glucose. That's the overall process, okay? And I talked before about the fact that we can give it a summary reaction, which is basically a way of pretending as though it happens in one step, even though it doesn't. Remember, we talked about the reciprocal relationship between the complete oxidation of glucose, which has a summary reaction in one direction, and the reciprocal process, which is photosynthesis. It has a summary reaction in the reverse direction. Neither of them happens in one step. The summary reaction just pretends that. It happens in many steps. So the overall process is complete oxidation of glucose. There's two major subdivisions of that, two major components to the complete oxidation of glucose. The first one is glycolysis, which can also be called the glycolytic pathway. So it's part one of the overall process. Right? The second part of the complete oxidation of glucose is cellular respiration. That's why I was saying last time that I wish the chapter were not called cellular respiration, like that's the whole process, because it's only part of the process. Okay, so parts one and two in order are glycolysis and cellular respiration. Together, they make up the overall complete oxidation of glucose. All right. Notice the mitochondrion that's shown here. So we're looking at this as it occurs in a eukaryotic cell, even though cellular respiration was invented by bacteria. We're looking at it from the viewpoint of a eukaryote. So the kind of ecru background here, whatever color it is represents the cytosol. The cell is bigger than the room. This is just part of the cytosol, which is the liquid part of cytoplasm. It's in the cell, but it's outside of the membrane-bounded organelles. That cytosol, that fluid, is where the first part, glycolysis, occurs, which is why the glycolysis box is in the cytosol. All right? Now, even though cytosol is part one of the overall process, cytosol itself is not just one step. Glycolysis itself is not just one step. In fact, there are 10 steps to just glycolysis. We'll look at greater detail of glycolysis a bit later, but glycolysis is itself, just by nothing but glycolysis, a pathway. It's a 10-step pathway. Glycolysis as a word means sugar splitting. Lysis is splitting, just like in hydrolysis of something. And glyco means sugar. Now, it makes sense that glycolysis is the first part of the overall process, because the overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose, meaning you start with glucose. Glucose is sugar. Glucose gets split. So once again, the way that we efficiently use, if we want to maximize, or any organism, maximize the amount of energy that you can usefully get out of glucose. By usefully, I mean put to work doing something. Because remember, some of that energy is going to be wasted as heat. You can't do anything about that. But the way that we maximize the energy extracted from a glucose fuel molecule, there's two aspects to that. We want to completely dehydrogenate it, pick all of the hydrogens off, in other words. And we want to completely dismantle the carbon skeleton. Well, glucose is a hexose. So it's made up of a carbon skeleton featuring 6 carbons hooked together,
but there's a bunch of hydrogens on it as well, because it's a monosaccharide. All right? If we want to get all of the usable energy we can out of it, we're going to end up removing all of the hydrogens and dismantling all of the carbons from each other. And that's why the ultimate end product, like in any combustion reaction of an organic fuel, is just individual carbon dioxide molecules. Each carbon dioxide molecule doesn't have any hydrogen in it. It's been removed. And it features only one of however many carbons there are in the skeleton. Okay? Well, glycolysis does not completely use the fuel. It only partially uses the fuel. But glucose is the original fuel, and it is a six-carbon fuel. It's a six-carbon compound. In 10 steps, it's going to get split into 2 3-carbon compounds, each of which is called pyruvate. So there's 2 copies of pyruvate that get produced, which makes sense. You're starting with 6-carbon compound, you're breaking it into 2 3-carbon compounds. And that's why it's called sugar splitting or glycolysis. You should expect that process of breaking a big, more complex thing into smaller, less complex things to be exergonic, right? It's catabolic, and that corresponds to exergonic. So it does release some energy. And that's why, notice on the bottom, you have some ATP being formed as a result of glycolysis. In the overall process, complete oxidation of glucose, the goal, so to speak, is to produce ATP molecules, because the ATP stores energy that was in the fuel, but it stores it in a way just like money, that is versatile. You can spend it doing a whole lot of different things, which we talked about before. Any ATP is indistinguishable from any other ATP. So this ATP that's produced by glycolysis is just part of the overall goal. But glycolysis doesn't produce all that much ATP. And that's because we don't completely burn the glucose in glycolysis. The pyruvate that is the end product of glycolysis is itself still useful fuel. It still has multiple carbons in the skeleton, 3 per pyruvate, and it still has hydrogens that can be picked off. So there's still energy that can be extracted from pyruvate. That's part of why the ATP that's produced by glycolysis is only part of what can be produced. Importantly, though, you have another ATP that's produced by glycolysis is carrying energy. That's the goal. But importantly, glycolysis also produces reduced coenzyme molecules, NADH. And those are carrying energy as well. In fact, each NADH is carrying more energy than an ATP molecule. It's just not in the final form. If the goal is ATP, coenzymes, these taxis, NADH, is carrying enough energy to eventually produce multiple ATP molecules to get to that goal. So think about glycolysis as having inputs and outputs, even though it's not one step. It's a pathway, but there are inputs and outputs. The inputs are glucose, the fuel, oxidized coenzymes, in other words, NAD plus molecules, and ADP molecules, which are lower energy than ATP, right? Those then get transformed into pyruvate, partially spent fuel, in other words, but not entirely spent fuel. ATP, because the ADP gets phosphorylated, and reduced coenzymes, because the NAD plus picks up electrons and protons from hydrogens that get removed from the fuel. All of this making sense? Right, because you have to have ADP to form ATP by phosphorylating the ADP. Okay. That is glycolysis, and notice under the ATP bubble that it says the ATP is formed by a process called substrate-level phosphorylation. I'll explain that with a picture. But that's not the only way to make ATP. That's just how it's accomplished in glycolysis. Some cells, it depends on the species, some cells are capable of glycolysis only. So they are stuck with this little bit of ATP when they use a glucose. But in cells that are capable of cellular respiration, that's what cellular respiration is all about. Processing the already partially spent, but only partially spent fuel that glycolysis spits out, pyruvate, and continuing to process it as fuel until you have happened what I've said is happening in if you maximally efficiently use your fuel. In other words, the rest of the hydrogens will be picked off and the carbon skeleton will be totally dismantled. That's what happens in cellular respiration. So that the only thing left of the fuel originally, glucose, will be carbon dioxide molecules. And you should think of carbon dioxide as being worthless in terms of energy, as fuel. CO2 is completely spent fuel, and that's why we get rid of it. But the CO2 that you breathe out is just what's left over from the food that you ate. You digest your food into small molecules, absorb those, use them as fuel, burn them as fuel, in other words, until all that's left is CO2 and you get rid of that. All right, so the second part of the overall process is cellular respiration, and that has as an input pyruvate, which is the output of the first part, glycolysis. But notice that whereas glycolysis happens in the cytosol, cellular respiration in a eukaryote occurs in a mitochondrion, which is the yellow organelle here. And also remember that a mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. There's an outer membrane and an inner membrane, and therefore just within the mitochondrion itself there are two separate compartments. An intermembrane space between the two membranes, and a mitochondrial matrix fully inside the inner membrane. That's where cellular respiration takes place, in a mitochondrion. So, think about where we are on the overall process. The overall process has the two parts. Glycolysis is the first. Cellular respiration is the second. That second part, which is cellular respiration, can then be broken down into three components itself. Okay? The first part, which isn't really shown very well on this picture, the first part of cellular respiration is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The phrase should make already some sense because it's saying something's happening to pyruvate. That's the starting point of cellular respiration, because cellular respiration starts where glycolysis leaves off. In this figure, the first part of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, is represented simply by this white arrow. So the pyruvate is out in the cytosol to begin with, because that's where glycolysis happens. But for it to be processed as fuel by cellular respiration, it needs to be put into a mitochondrion where cellular respiration occurs. So part of the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate involves importing the pyruvate through the two membranes of the mitochondrion to get it in there. Okay, that's part one of cellular respiration. Part two is called the citric acid cycle. That's one of its three names. It can also go by Krebs cycle, which is named after a dead human, or it can be called the tricarboxylic acid cycle.
which is sometimes abbreviated TCA cycle.
I'll explain why those names make sense eventually. But that's part two of cellular respiration. Notice that part one of cellular respiration, which was this oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, does not produce any ATP. Part two, the citric acid cycle, does produce some ATP, which is the goal. And also notice that the way the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle is produced is the same way it's produced in glycolysis, substrate level phosphorylation. The final and part three step of cellular respiration is called oxidative phosphorylation, the purple box. But that third step, that third part, consists of two parts itself. So you can break down part three of cellular respiration, oxidative phosphorylation, into its two components, electron transport and chemiosmosis. This is the big payoff in terms of the goal, which is to produce as much ATP as possible. That's why the ATP bubble here is bigger. It's not that this ATP molecule is any more valuable. All ATP is the same. The bigger yellow balloon here means that this final step is where most of the ATP molecules get produced compared to what was produced earlier. Also, though, the way it's produced is different. This final batch of ATP is not produced via substrate-level phosphorylation. It occurs via oxidative phosphorylation, and I'll explain the difference once we get to pictures. But that's where we are in the overall process. We'll see a similar slide like this once we get through the particulars and review it again. Let's go to 10 and make sense of this phrase substrate level phosphorylation. That's what we have happening here. Well, just looking at the phrase substrate level phosphorylation should tell you that this involves an enzyme and a substrate, right? Substrate is something that binds to an enzyme. The goal is to phosphorylate ADP, which is like a lower balance debit card, making a deposit, right? Making it a more valuable energy-carrying molecule, ATP. ADP already has two phosphates of its own, but we invest it with more energy by sticking a third phosphate on it to make it ATP. Well, in substrate-level phosphorylation, a substrate of some kind is originally carrying the phosphate. In other words, it's not a phosphate just on its own. It's a phosphate currently being carried by a substrate. And when that substrate binds to an enzyme, the enzyme speeds up the process of transferring that phosphate from the substrate to ADP, turning the ADP into ATP. And now the substrate is dephosphorylated.
So the substrate's the input?
The substrate is, and the phosphate it's carrying are inputs. And ADP is an input into this process. The output is an unphosphorylated product, whatever the substrate gets turned into, and ATP, because the phosphate is now on the ATP molecule. And, of course, the enzyme doesn't get changed because it's a catalyst. All right, that's substrate-level phosphorylation, and that is how the ATP gets produced in two places in the overall process. In glycolysis, substrate-level phosphorylation happens to produce some ATP, and in the citric acid cycle, substrate-level phosphorylation produces some ATP. Now we can talk about glycolysis, which is part one of the overall process. Like I said, it by itself is 10 steps, and not all of it is shown here, not all the details. This is really just a balance sheet, so to speak. We'll look at the steps in a minute. But the importance of this slide, 11, is that it shows that the overall glycolysis process can be thought of as occurring in two major phases, the so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. Now, these are good descriptors of what's going on because the goal, remember, is to produce ATP. Well, the energy investment phase not only doesn't produce any ATP, it actually uses ATP. That's why it's called energy investment. It's kind of like the financial adage, it takes money to make money, right? You invest money, but in the end, you end up making more than you started with. So it's worth it. So these are per glucose numbers that we're looking at here. For each glucose that gets processed, the energy investment phase requires spending two ATPs. And by spending, I mean you turn two ATPs into two ADPs. You take some of the money out of the debit card. And that's the investment. You're going backwards, so to speak, in terms of the goal. But the reason it's worth it is because you have to do that in order to get to the energy payoff phase. And the energy payoff phase produces 4 ATP per glucose. And therefore, since you spent 2 to earn 4, you have a net gain of 2 ATPs. Right? That's why it's worth it. Now, the ATP are the goals, as I keep saying, but they're not the only thing carrying energy here. ATP doesn't have to be processed into anything else. It's ready to go. That's the goal. But notice on this balance sheet on the bottom that this energy payoff phase pays off in terms of more than just ATP. Because in the energy payoff phase, two NAD pluses, two empty taxis, oxidized NADs, get reduced into NAD plus, NADH and H plus. And like I said, they are carrying not only energy, but even more energy than the ATPs are. So these full taxis are important. They're picking up the electrons and protons from the hydrogens that are getting stripped from the fuel as it gets processed. This is not part of cellular respiration. This is glycolysis. It's the first thing to happen in the overall process. It's part one of the complete oxidation of glucose. And this happens out in the cytosol. Okay? Just the main compartment of the cell, not within the mitochondrion yet. Go ahead.
I noticed in the payoff phase it says we use 4 ADP. I understand where the first two come from, but where does the other two ADP come from?
What do you mean by the other two? Oh, you're talking about this compared to this?
Yes.
Well, think of your body as a city with respect to this taxi analogy. There is a fleet of taxis, however many cars big, in the whole city, right? And similarly, you have so many taxis in your body. At any given moment, some of them are in ADP form, some of them are in ATP form, but it's just a pool of coenzymes. And so these are just two of those, two of the empty versions these two ATP are two of the full versions that have to be used in the process, and that empties them, so now you have two more empty ones in the pool. These four ADPs are empty ones that are part of the pool as well, but they get filled up in the process. So you have so many total ADP or ATPs, and any given one is in one form or the other. But they just, to get to all throughout the body, they just make up a pool of taxis, a fleet. Were you going to ask something?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you said the energy investment phase and then the energy payoff phase were process of what?
They're the two subphases of glycolysis. Glycolysis occurs in 10 steps, but it's useful energetically to think of it as two phases because in one phase you have to spend energy and in the other phase you make even more energy than you spent. Now we can look at the detail of glycolysis starting on slide 12. I say starting on 12 because this isn't all 10 steps. If you look quickly at 12 and 13, together, they make up the overall glycolytic pathway or glycolysis. And what we're seeing in 12 is the energy investment phase. This is where we have to spend energy, which we don't really want to do, but we have to in order to get to the second part, which pays off. Well, obviously we're starting with glucose. Now, I said there's 10 steps. These are the first five, but I don't want you to memorize all these intermediates. You would have to do that in a biochemistry course, but not in this course, because that's not really the main point. One main point, as I've said already, is that you're partially using the fuel. Fuel starts out as a 6-carbon glucose with a 6-carbon skeleton and a bunch of hydrogens. To get the energy, we want to dehydrogenate and dismantle the skeleton. That's only partially done in glycolysis. But here in step one, every one of these steps with the blue numbers, notice, features its own enzyme. That should be old news at this point. Every individual step of a pathway requires its own enzyme. But notice in step one, right away we have to spend some energy in the form of ATP. ATP is getting turned into ADP. In other words, ATP, when you use it, gets dephosphorylated, right? You're taking one of the phosphates off. Where does it go? On to the fuel itself. That's why glucose is getting turned into glucose 6-phosphate, because the phosphate is associated with the 6th carbon. Phosphorylating the fuel energizes the fuel, so that this is why it can later pay off. But we haven't broken anything apart yet, right? This is still a 6-carbon compound, and we haven't dehydrogenated it. The rest of this is really just rearranging the skeleton. You spend another ATP here, so now we still have a 6-carbon fuel, this fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, but now it's doubly phosphated. That's what the bis means, same as bi, means 2 phosphates. We haven't broken it down yet, though, so there isn't really any lysis occurring yet. But we have to get to fructose 1,6-bisphosphate to get to this fork in the road, which is shown in greater detail here. The reason it's a fork in the road is because this is because there's 2 possibilities when we split this thing apart. We're splitting a 6-carbon fuel into 2 3-carbon fuels. But there's multiple possible ways that can happen. You can produce either dihydroxyacetone phosphate or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Each of them has 3 carbons. Now, if you look at the smaller version, this is the same fork in the road, notice that only the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is usually abbreviated as G3P, only that has a down arrow below it, continuing on to the next slide, which is the rest of glycolysis. This one doesn't. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate can't go on to the next step, which you would think would be a problem because you want to get to the energy payoff phase. It's not a problem, though, because even though it's random as to which one will be formed, if you make the wrong one, dihydroxyacetone phosphate, it can easily be rearranged into the right one, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And doing that rearrangement is simply to turn one isomer into another isomer, right? They have the same chemical formulae. That's why, by the way, the enzyme responsible for that is called isomerase. It isomerizes dihydroxyacetone phosphate into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So it doesn't matter which one you make. In essence, ultimately, 2 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates for each glucose you started with goes on to the energy payoff phase, and you don't waste anything.
Isomerase is the reason there's an arrow back and forth.
That's right.
It converts it back and forth.
That's right.
It stops doing it when it's spent.
That's exactly right, yes. It can go either direction. The enzyme will work in either direction, but it's going to be favored to the right because you're going to use this up and you're not going to use this up. So taking it away means it's going to go this way. It's an example of Le Chatelier's principle in chemistry, but you don't have to know that. Okay, let's look at the next slide, 13, which is the rest of glycolysis. This collectively is the energy payoff phase. All these numbers are per glucose originally. So this is somewhat confusing at first. We've split the glucose into two different pieces, right, already? And so that's why you have twos in front of these. Because each of these things happens for each of the two three-carbon compounds, each of the two G3Ps gets processed. All right? And right away, step six, we have part of the payoff. An empty taxi, NAD+, comes in, picks up some hydrogens, two electrons and two protons, to become NADH and H+. It's carrying energy from the fuel now. That's part of the payoff. But it's a, what I was saying is that it's not that two taxis come in for each particle. There are two particles, though, since you split glucose into two, and therefore two taxis end up getting filled. Okay? And then the next step is in more of the payoff because you have an ADP getting phosphorylated into ATP. That phosphate that you put onto the fuel in the payoff, I mean in the investment phase earlier, gets used now to stick it back onto an ADP. That's trying to get back to even, right? Well, down here on step 10, you have even more ATP being produced. So per glucose, you get 2 plus 2, 4 overall ATP. You took 2 to get there, though, so it's you're earning only 2 net. Importantly, though, you also earn 2 NADHs. That is gets you to the end. The end product, fuel-wise, is pyruvate. Still valuable stuff, but glycolysis can't do anything with it. Glycolysis is done. And so you have made a little bit of energy, and you've stored some in coenzyme, NADH, but in terms of goal, you're not really close to the goal because pyruvate is still valuable. You still have a carbon skeleton to dismantle. You still have hydrogens you can pick off. That's more energy that can be extracted, and that's why cellular respiration evolved, to keep processing the partially spent fuel and maximize the production of ATP ultimately. All right, that all happened out in the cytosol, glycolysis. Now it's time to look at greater detail at cellular respiration, which is part two of the overall process. But cellular respiration, remember, has three parts of its own. And here we're looking at the first part of cellular respiration, which I told you before is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. For that to happen, pyruvate has to go from where it's produced, which is out in the cytosol where glycolysis produces it, into the organelle of cellular respiration, which is the mitochondrion. So that's why this white arrow is showing pyruvate moving from the cytosol through the membranes into the mitochondrion. That's just part of oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, but let's make sense of the rest of the name of this phrase. Oxidative means it's going to involve redox. So there's going to be transfers of electrons. What about decarboxylation? Well, D means removal, right? Just like dehydrogenation is removal of hydrogen. Think about what a carboxyl group is. Do you remember what a carboxyl functional group? Okay, well, look at pyruvate. You have a structural formula for pyruvate here, which is the starting part of cellular respiration. It has three carbons, right? But one of those carbons is doubly bound to an oxygen, singly bound to an OH, but at physiological pHs, the O loses the H, and you just have a hydrogen in solution. So you memorized originally when I taught you a carboxyl as being C double bond O and single OH. Well, this is still a carboxyl. It's just a deprotonated or a deprotonated carboxyl, which is one that has lost a proton. The shading, though, is here, though, to show you that this is a carboxyl that's part of pyruvate. Decarboxylation means the carboxyl gets removed from that fuel. So decarboxylation is part of the dismantling of the carbon skeleton I keep talking about. Right? So that's further processing of the fuel. And when you remove a carboxyl, which doesn't have any hydrogen attached to it anymore, what do you have? That previous carboxyl that was part of a bigger thing by itself is just CO2. Just becomes CO2, which is completely spent fuel, right? That's what you breathe out. So that CO2 that you see happening here happens once for each of the pyruvates, but there's two pyruvates per glucose that you started with, remember. So two CO2s are produced per glucose starting the process in this first part of cellular respiration. I say two because if we do completely process the fuel and dismantle it completely, you'll have six carbon dioxides at the end because you start with a six carbon skeleton. This is two of the six. All right? But decarboxylating the pyruvate, which started out as three carbons, is still going to leave valuable fuel because you still have a carbon skeleton made up of two carbons now with some hydrogens attached. This two carbon end product of the decarboxylation of pyruvate by itself would be called an acetyl group. Okay? That is still valuable fuel. Just it's getting less and less valuable the more we dismantle it, but it's still not completely spent. All right? That's the end product. But look what happens on the way. Not only do you produce CO2 because of the decarboxylation, the oxidative part of the phrase refers to the fact that in this process of converting pyruvate to acetyl, NAD+, an empty taxi, comes along and picks up hydrogens to form NADH and H+. So you don't produce any ATP, like I told you in the summary slide. In this step, no ATP gets produced. But even more valuable, NADH gets produced. And what the passengers that it picked up were in glucose originally, but they get picked off of pyruvate. All right. Now, this thing in white, notice, is labeled acetyl coenzyme A. Here stands for coenzyme. Coenzyme A, just like NAD, is a coenzyme. And like I said, coenzymes act as little carriers or taxis. Well, coenzyme A, just by itself, just this orangish part, would be an empty taxi. Its passenger, though, is the entire acetyl, what's left of the fuel. And when this acetyl passenger is riding in the coenzyme A taxi, we call the whole thing acetyl coenzyme A. Acetyl needs the help of the taxi to get to the next part of cellular respiration, part two of cellular respiration, which maybe you'll recall is the citric acid cycle. That's the job of coenzyme A, to drive acetyl, which is produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, step one, to part two, which is the citric acid cycle, and drop it off. Well, we can see that in slide 15. So this is a simplified schematic version of really parts 1 and 2 together of cellular respiration. The top part, this arrow by itself, represents the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And the fuel here is, we don't even bother drawing any oxygens or hydrogens, it's just represented by the carbon skeleton. Three carbons hooked together represent pyruvate. It's a three-carbon fuel at this point. It gets decarboxylated, and the carboxyl is one of those three carbons, with oxygen, so that's one of the CO2s. But you get another CO2 from the other pyruvate because you split glucose into two pyruvates. That's why I said two of the six possible CO2s are formed in that step. That leaves you two carbon compounds, two identical versions of acetyl, one for each of the pyruvates. And it gets picked up, each one gets picked up by its own coenzyme A taxi. The whole thing is called acetyl coenzyme A only during the short trip until the taxi drops it off to part two of the cellular respiration process, which is the citric acid cycle. So the coenzyme A does not enter the cycle. It just drops off acetyl itself, which is the fuel at this point, to the citric acid cycle. The circular part, of course, is the citric acid cycle itself. That's part two of cellular respiration. And like I said, that can be called citric acid cycle, it can be called Krebs cycle, or it can be called tricarboxylic acid cycle. Those all mean exactly the same thing, so they're totally interchangeable. The details, the fine details of the citric acid cycle are not shown here. We'll look at that in the next slide. But important part, as far as energy is concerned, is shown here. The citric acid cycle, one thing that it accomplishes is it completes the oxidation of the fuel. We started with glucose. At this point, citric acid cycle gets what's left over of the fuel, which is acetyl, right? Two acetyls. It's still fuel. Citric acid cycle completes the oxidation. So remember what the total overall process is, the complete oxidation of glucose, right? If you go the whole route and completely oxidize it, all you have left are six carbon dioxides for the six carbon glucose you started with. Citric acid cycle completes that process. And that's why you see one of the outputs of the citric acid cycle is two more CO2s, one for each of the two acetyls that enter. Oh, I'm sorry, two for each of the acetyls that enter. This acetyl is two carbons. When it gets broken apart, each one is one of the carbons in a CO2 molecule. But you also have two more CO2s when the other acetyl that you have entering gets processed. So that's four more CO2s plus the two in this previous step. That's your overall six carbon dioxides. Totally spent fuel. No more fuel remaining at this point after the citric acid cycle. Now, the goal has not been met. So even though the fuel is gone, there's still more to the overall process because the goal is to maximize ATP production. Well, the citric acid cycle does itself produce some ATP, as you see here. And this is produced the same way as it's produced in glycolysis, meaning via substrate-level phosphorylation. But that's still not all the ATP that can be produced. The fuel is gone, but we have ATP. We also have even more full taxis produced by the citric acid cycle. NAD plus picks up electrons and protons to become NADH and H plus. There's three of them here are in the cycle, not all at the same place, but this is a summary. And you also have a different company, so to speak, of taxi being filled. FAD is another coenzyme, very similar to nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide that we've been talking about, except the nitrogenous base that gets oxidized in FAD is not nicotinamide, it's flavin. So it's flavin adenine dinucleotide. All right? And it works the same way, it just has a different nitrogenous base. One difference, though, is remember I explained about why you can only put two electrons and one proton into NAD plus, and you have that leftover proton. That's not a problem with FAD because it's not FAD plus when it's empty. It's just FAD. And therefore, you have two electrons and two protons to work with. Well, that means overall two hydrogen atoms. All four of those particles can go on to FAD to make it into the reduced form FADH2. No leftover protons. Multiple ones. Four taxis become reduced. NAD plus into NADHs, three of them, and FAD into FADH2. Yes, well, originally it started out as part of glucose. By the time you get here, it was part of pyruvate for step one. But for the citric acid cycle itself, the energy is in acetyl, because that's all that's left of the fuel at that point. But acetyl is just what's left over what started out as glucose. All right, let's go then to 16 and look at the same cycle in greater detail. Once again, I don't want you to memorize all these intermediates, but I want to mention first that it's a cycle. Well, a cycle is still a biochemical pathway. The pathways we've looked at so far have been linear pathways, means there's a beginning and an end, but some number of steps, some number of chemical reactions arranged end to end. A cycle is also a pathway. It's just what makes it a pathway is that the end of the pathway then feeds the beginning again. And so, in a sense, this top part of the circle is a start-finish line in racing terms. Notice the end, which would be oxaloacetate, is getting turned into the start, which is called citrate or citric acid. This is why it's called the citric acid cycle. All right. A moment ago, I said that fuel-wise, the importance of the citric acid cycle is that it completes the breakdown of the fuel. It dismantles the skeleton completely, right? You don't have any more fuel left by the time the citric acid cycle is done. Dismantling means taking apart that carbon skeleton. But ironically, what's happening here at the start-finish line is that you have oxaloacetate, this intermediate. Notice it has four carbons. And coenzyme A is dropping off acetyl, which is all that's left of the fuel at this point. It has two carbons. And you join the two to produce citrate, which has six carbons. So that's really accomplishing the opposite of what you want to consider as far as dismantling is concerned, right? You're making an even bigger skeleton. But that allows then for the stepwise dismantling. And notice that here and here, you have a carbon come off in the form of carbon dioxide. So these two carbon dioxides that are coming off, those can be thought of as the two carbons that make up the acetyl that enters the cycle. And the other acetyl, because you have two of them coming in for each glucose, are going to yield their own CO2s. That's four for this process, plus the two from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate to add up to six carbon dioxides. The fuel is gone. There's nothing else you can get out of CO2 energetic-wise. But the process is not complete because we haven't maximized the production of ATP. We did make some more down here via substrate-level phosphorylation. But in terms of energy, the big payoff of the citric acid cycle is that you make all these reduced coenzymes. 3-NADH is an H+, per acetyl, and 1-FADH2. The fuel is gone, so there's no more usable energy in that. Some of the energy that was originally in glucose has been put into ATP form, which is the goal. Some of the energy has been lost as heat at each step along the way. There's no way avoiding that, right? But at this point, even though the fuel is gone, most of the energy that was in that glucose originally, all of the energy that hasn't been either wasted as heat or already put into ATP, is at this point in the form of reduced coenzymes, full taxis, NADH NH pluses and FADH2s. And just keep in mind that they didn't all get produced in the citric acid cycle. There was some NADH and H plus produced in glycolysis. That's storing some of the glucose's energy. There was NADH and H plus produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's carrying some of the energy that was in glucose. And there's a bunch more NADH and H plus produced in the citric acid cycle, along with FADH2. All of these are full taxis now. And their cargo is energy in the form of electrons and protons that came from the fuel. This is why the process isn't complete, though, because even though the fuel is gone, the energy that the taxis are carrying are not in their final desired form, which is ATP form. That's why you need part three of cellular respiration, to now finally deal with all of these energetic passengers that the taxis are carrying and put them to use, building a lot more ATP molecules. That's what part three is all about. And part three of cellular respiration, recall, is called oxidative phosphorylation. That brings us to 17. Everyone still hanging on here? Okay. 17 is kind of a two pictures in one, by which I mean, for one thing, it's a graph. Notice the y-axis here, free energy. So the higher you are on this graph, the higher the energy is. And notice that there's a downward trend here. That's because energy is going to be lost in this process. Free energy is released. But it's also, in a sense, at least a cartoon example of an anatomical figure. All of these purple blobs are protein complexes. And together, well, there's four particularly big protein complexes here, which are the ones that get the Roman numerals. 1, 2, 3, and 4. These four protein complexes together make up what is called an electron transport chain. And I say "and" because a lot of times in textbooks they'll talk about the electron transport chain, that it's as though there's only one. There are millions and millions of them. They're all identical. This is just one copy of an electron transport chain. All right? But it consists of four major protein complexes plus some other smaller particles. It's called the electron transport chain because of what it accomplishes, which is the process of electron transport. And if you go back a couple slides, you'll see that part three of cellular respiration, which is what we're in right now, oxidative phosphorylation, has two parts to it, the first part of which is electron transport. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at the structure that accomplishes electron transport. Electron transport is the process. Now, you don't see the detail here, but this electron transport chain and all the millions of other copies of it are not floating around in fluid. They are embedded in membrane. But what membrane are they embedded in? Well, there are two membranes in the mitochondrion.
The inner
one. Only the inner. So remember that a mitochondrion has an inner membrane that's even bigger than the outer one because the inner one is folded. That's why you have all those cristae, which are the folds. That maximizes the amount of membrane, and therefore it can hold a lot more copies of electron transport chains. Okay, so you don't see the membrane here, but you will in a different picture. Each electron transport chain, though, is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Now, let's talk about what is happening here, the process of electron transport. Even though it's kind of an old-fashioned analogy, I usually use the analogy of a bucket brigade. Does anyone know what I mean by a bucket brigade? Well, for the young people, I will explain this old-fashioned term. If you live out in the middle of nowhere and there aren't any fire hydrants, you have a well, that's your water source, and your barn's on fire, you don't call the fire department that doesn't exist there. Neighbors come by, they see the fire, they come by and want to help. Your only source of water is the well, so the people line up in what's called a bucket brigade, so that they don't have to run back and forth from the well to the fire. There's one person at the well that fills the bucket, passes it on to the next person, and so on. Similar thing, yes, exactly the same thing. Rather than walking back and forth, you just pass the thing to the next person. That's what an electron transport chain is like, except it's not buckets of water, of course. What gets transported back and forth, from one member of the chain to the next, are electrons, and that's why the process is called electron transport. Okay, now, where do these electrons come from? Well, they were in glucose originally. But think about the fact that it's electrons that are being transported. The first member of the chain, which is complex 1, is what receives electrons originally. And chemically speaking, what does that mean is happening to that first member of the chain by receiving those electrons? It's becoming reduced, exactly. It's not going to stay reduced, though, because it's part of the brigade. It needs to pass the electrons that are just received on to the next member. So that's going to reoxidize the first member, and it's going to reduce the second member. And so on, right? So each transfer of electrons is a redox reaction. An electron transport chain operates as a series of redox reactions as these electrons get transferred down the chain. And the reason I say down the chain explains why this is shown as a diagonal downward direction. Not because they're slanted anatomically in the mitochondrion, but because of the graphic aspect of this. Every time electrons get transported from one member to the next, they end up, those electrons, getting a little bit closer to the new nucleus they're associated with. And think about energy levels on an atom. The lowest energy level is the one closest to the nucleus. Farther from the nucleus is higher energy. The electrons end up getting closer and closer to an atomic nucleus as they get past. That's why they're going down in G value. So this is how energy gets released gradually from the fuel. Why do I say fuel? Because the source of these electrons is the taxis that pick these electrons up from the fuel along the way. NADH and FADH2, I keep telling you, are carrying valuable cargo in the form of electrons and protons. It's not the protons that get passed along. It's the electrons. But as they do, they release a little bit of energy at a time in manageable steps. Okay? Now, all of these members of the chain operate as part of the brigade. They transport electrons. But three of these four Roman numeral complexes, the three biggest ones, 1, 3, and 4, they have a totally separate job. They do double duty, in other words. They are electron transporters, but they also function as pumps. And keep in mind, they are embedded in a intermitochondrial membrane, where you would expect to see a pump, right? Specifically, they are proton pumps. So they're not only acting as pumps, they're specifically pumping protons. Now, what should immediately come to mind when I say pump?
Gradient.
Well, gradient could apply whether it's a pump or not, right? That's another example of a pump, but why do we call transporters pumps? Some transporters, not all transporters. Right. When you hear pump, you should, in your mind, immediately say that's active transport that's happening. So a proton pump is a transporter that moves protons against their gradient, moves them in the opposite direction compared to how they want to move, taking them from where they're already lower concentration and moving them to where they're already higher concentration. And what do you know about active transport in general?
It needs energy.
Yes, it needs some external source of energy. It doesn't have a built-in source of energy that will allow it to happen like passive transport does. And it therefore will not happen at all unless you provide that external source of energy. Well, we looked at a proton pump already in one of our examples. That was in a plant. Remember when I explained primary active transport and secondary active transport? The secondary active transport moved the sucrose in. Well, for the pump by itself, for primary active transport, that primary proton pump that we looked at for plants, what was the source of energy? Driving it.
ATP,
right. And it often is for pumps. Not always, though. Well, here, it would be silly to use ATP to power these pumps because the goal is to produce ATP, right? And you're never going to get as much energy out as you put in, so spending ATP would not work. You can't get around needing energy, though. There has to be an energy source. So even though these three pumps that are part of each chain pump protons, they don't do it at the expense of ATP. What provides the energy? I already gave you the answer. What provides the energy is the gradual release of energy as the electrons get transported. This drop in G, that's usable energy, at least the part that isn't wasted as heat. All right? So electron transport releases energy, some of which gets harnessed by and drives the three protein complexes that operate as pumps. The electron transport powers the pumping of protons. And think about what was removed from the fuel. When you dehydrogenate the fuel, you get two kinds of particles, right? Electrons and protons being carried by the taxis. The electrons trickle down through the chains. That provides energy. And the protons get pumped through these three complexes of the chain using the energy from the electrons. Is that all of that clear? Now, there is no more fuel left, right? We've spent that in the citric acid cycle. This has nothing to do with fuel anymore. The fuel is gone, but until we get to this point, right before this part, where is most of the energy that was originally in glucose? And FADH2, yes. In other words, in the form of reduced coenzymes. Those are the taxis. All these taxis picked up electrons and protons at different places in the overall process, starting with glycolysis. But they're all driving to the same destination, which is an electron transport chain. So the electrons that get delivered to this first member of the chain come from NADH. NADH drops off its electrons and protons. That turns it back into NAD+, an empty taxi. But the electrons then get passed on. That's when the energy gets released. And that energy release allows the other passenger, the protons, to be pumped through the membrane, through these complexes, 1, 3, and 4. Notice, by the way, that NADH, which is one company of taxis, can drop off its passengers at the first complex, whereas FADH2 can't do that. It has to drop it off at the second, which is at slightly lower energy. So it's for that reason, it's not quite as valuable as NADH2. I mean, as NADH. But that's the process of electron transport. And why do this? Why pump protons? You don't have any more fuel left. You still haven't made as much ATP as you can. Why go through this process of pumping protons? What does that get you? Well, what does any pump accomplish? The production of a gradient. So the pumping here produces a gradient so that there is a high concentration on the intermembrane space where they get pumped to, and a low concentration of protons in the matrix where they get pumped from. Why is that in itself valuable? Because of something I keep repeating. A gradient is a form of stored energy, and it can be put to work for you. So you don't have any fuel left, but the energy that you still have from the fuel is now being temporarily stored in the form of a proton gradient. That's what electron transport accomplishes. And it's not the final payoff because we still haven't put that gradient to use. But the final step, which is part two of oxidative phosphorylation, otherwise known as chemiosmosis, which I'll have to explain next time, that's when the final payoff of ATP production gets used, and it does so by using the energy that's stored as the proton gradient. All right.